in Schools History Project.
Yeah.
And you probably know that paper two in Schools History Project was the sources paper. And it had to be on a topic that students hadn't studied.
No, the unseen one, yes.
The unseen, yeah. It was abolished as a paper in the late 90s, I think. But it was quite a challenge to write, because A, you had to find a topic that people hadn't done, and then you had to make it a viable inquiry. Yeah. I mean, it was no good just giving them sources and asking them. Probably one of my criticisms of current GCSEs is that people are asked about sources for no reason other than their sources, whereas if you were creating a paper, you had to create an inquiry. So, I don't know, probably the best one to show you. This was the very first paper I wrote, which was about Tenochtitlan.
How long did that run for, that joint one?
Joint O-level CSE ran from 1985 through to 1987.
Right, so just 2 years.
Just 2 years. Yeah. So, 85, 86, 87. It was three exams.
And was that only for SHP?
No.
You could do it in the modern world.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. A lot of the names you will have come across were involved in the joint O-level CSE. So Rosemary Rees and Sue Stiles, for example, yeah. You'll have come across. They were the two chief examiners for O-level SHP, which I started working for them when I became an examiner.
Yeah.
But they became joint O-level CSE. Nick Tate was joint. This was Syllabus D for LEAG, that you're talking about. Syllabus A was Nick Tate and Scott Harrison. The Nick Tate was from the O-level. Scott Harrison was CSE. Scott Harrison, most recently, HMI for History.
So was that seen as a sort of preliminary to introducing the GCSE?
Yeah.
But had it come out spontaneously from the boards, or was it a response
to... No, it was a response to the move towards GCSE. So it was seen as a way of trialling GCSE and trialling the awarding of GCSE in that period. Mm. I was just trying to think who else was involved. People like Colin Shepherd.
Oh, yeah.
He was an examiner under me on Syllabus D. I can't quite remember now who would... But there were four... There was A, which was Modern World. There was B, which was British and European. There was C, which was Social and Economic. And there was D, which was...
those would be the common syllabuses at that time, wouldn't
they? I was... Because of the sample papers, I had to do these papers out of 60 marks, which was nonsensical. So what I used to do was do... we used to do it out of... 120, I think, and then we'd halve the mark to get it to 60. But that's a nice example of a starter, an access question, right? So list three ways in which source B agrees with source A. Mm. So you've got your source booklet, and you've got your sources. So it's quite a big reading task.
It is, yeah. You know? So how long were they allowed for that?
This was a...
1¾ hours. Yeah.
So, and then you move up to the kind of more... So there's an incline of difficulty as you go through the questions, usually. And this one is usually a kind of synoptic question. Mm. And you can see that in... I mean, if you take Chris's paper one paper, you will see it in the... study source one. What medical treatment has been carried out in the skull? Almost certainly trepanning. I don't know. We've got sources. So, yeah.
So the that one was based on the medicine through time. So they already studied that.
Medicine through time and the study in depth,
right.
Because both of those were examined. Mm-hmm. So these were more traditional exams in the sense that they were based on known content, but still source questions and concept questions in terms of. Change in particular.
I hope you don't mind me saying this, but having compared, you know, having looked at more recent GCSE, these look more difficult.
Well, that could be. I couldn't possibly comment. I haven't seen any GCSE papers for a long time, but
would you have said that was accessible to a pupil who was expected to get an F or a GCSE.
Yeah, and indeed, one of the things we found the first year we did it was that we didn't get the same amount of spoiled papers. I mean, one of the things that was a great relief to you as an O-level examiner was when you got a paper and you opened it up and it just said, Manchester United football team players were... And that was it. You know, the kid had just kind of, I'm not doing it. But we didn't get that with joint O-level CSE. We used to get responses all the way through. I think we did spend a lot of time in the run-up to the papers looking at accessibility and language. And there is a question of how low can you go? And I've argued fairly consistently that differentiation by outcome, if you have an exam for the whole ability range, then it's got to be accessible to the whole range, and you don't have tiered papers, because nothing has convinced me that you can tier effectively in history, that you can say this is a lower tier paper that's, you know, this is fit for grades F to G, and this is, you know, because often you're tiering not on history, you're tiering on language.
But is that invalid, to tier on language, if the history is...
But you're also probably capping their ability to show their understanding as well. At least that's been my argument.
You think so?
Yeah. And I still think the public, for example, do not understand how it is that people can do a maths exam and score 80 out of 100, but only get a grade D. Because they don't understand that kids are being divided up.
Well, basically, the functions that they're asked to perform are limited, aren't they?
Yeah.
And you're saying that in history you can't limit the
those functions.
No. No, you can't. Well, in the past, I suppose, if you look at CSE and O level, the level, the way in which it was graded, was based on the level of factual information, the amount of factual information that the child was expected to put on the paper in a limited amount of time, and the complexity of the explanation that they put forward. Would you say that's fair? You weren't asking them, you weren't checking on their ability to think about history. No. You were checking on their ability to explain
to remember
things
and to then write it in a coherent way. I mean, Eric would argue that O level was about memory. And it was about the ability to write coherently, as opposed to think coherently. I mean, there's still an argument that says the minute you ask somebody to write down what they understand, you put a cap on their ability, because some kids can explain it, and Peter Lee's work was all about oracy and history in one sense. The minute you ask them to write it down, you put a limit on them. And that's true of any written examination, I think. But children often can explain a lot easier than they can write. And part of your training for any examination is to train people how to be able to express themselves on paper. I mean, a lot of A-level, for example, is actually teaching people how to write a coherent, argued essay, isn't it, if you think about it?
Yes.
And still, and always was. And you could argue that at university, the whole process is about being able to develop your thesis and to argue it out and put it on paper and get people to understand.
So would you say that in these exams where you were attempting to go across the ability range, you took the attention away from how coherently you explained, or the use of language and the amount of information you got on the page, towards a conceptual understanding, achieving some level of conceptual understanding about a problem?
That, I think, is what the function of the mark schemes was. The mark scheme was focusing far more about helping the examiner identify what level of thinking this child was showing, or what level of understanding this child was showing, and less so on how beautifully it had been written. Yeah, or how... I mean, don't get me wrong, that level of understanding required support from historical information and knowledge as well. So it wasn't an entire skills base. And when we come to talk about SHP later on, I mean, I'll talk to you about first generation and second generation of SHP, in my view. Probably a third generation as well. Between those who started with SHP, who understood all along that it was about skills, concepts and knowledge, to the kind of second generation who thought it was only about skills, and who actually became the parody that the press always picked up on, and will again, no doubt, as we go into another debate over history in the next 6 months, if Gove decides to rewrite the history curriculum. Because the press only operates on very black and white.
They want to boil everything down to a headline, don't they? Actually, there was an interesting Radio 4 programme on Monday night, with John Bew actually was hosting it. But Gove was on it, Michael Gove, and he actually made quite an intelligent comment about how skills were very valuable for pupils in history, but obviously he wanted to look at narrative and knowledge as well. So. Yeah. I was quite surprised that he didn't go straight for narrative, it's all about narrative, he didn't.
But there is an assumption, I think, by some, that narrative and knowledge isn't there.
Yeah.
And I think part of the issue that Sue and I had in developing a national curriculum between 1988 and 1993 or 1995, and Sue thereafter, because I then moved, as you saw, I kind of went more broadly, was trying to convince people that it was a compromise, an amalgam, not a compromise, because compromise suggests that somehow it's less. It was an amalgam, you know, it was a case of bringing the best of inquiry-based history into an understanding of the nation's heritage, the world's heritage. Heritage is the wrong word, I suppose, but...
I don't know. There is an argument that that's what it's about. Heritage is part and parcel. And certainly if you go back into the 50s and you look at what the Department of Education was putting out, or Board of Education then, I think, they talk about heritage quite a bit as being important.
Yeah, so it's having a kind of frame of reference against which to put things. And what I find, my daughter was taught humanities at school by a geography teacher.
For the whole of her secondary schooling?
In a grammar school, what's more. And never took GCSE history, or O-level history as it was then. She was 1987 when she took her exam, so she was the last. She took geography instead. But she has hardly any historical reference frame. So, you know, you say to her, Industrial Revolution, that doesn't kind of provide her with the kind of reference that it would provide you and I.
So actually you're not in favour of humanities and integrated studies?
I've always been, I'm not in favour of it, I've always been very sceptical of it. I did quite a lot of work with the Humanities Association, and as an advisor in ILEA, we used to look at humanities quite a lot. Particularly broad humanities that involved social sciences as well as geography and sometimes English. What I came to the view was that most humanities departments that worked because of very powerful teams of people and very strong leaders, and that the moment you took that strong leader out, once there was a change in the dynamics, the thing fell apart. So I've tended to be probably more subject-based than some of the people who were working for me in the early 20th century, in 21st century rather, in QCA. My last but one post in QCA was director of QCA Consulting, which was one of Ken Boston's ideas to sell the subject-based skill that QCA then had. Or to make money out of it. And so the idea was that I had to go into a kind of market relationship and find ways of selling this expertise, which was quite an interesting brief, really. But it meant I had all the subjects. I had all the research team, and we sold our... matrix working within any organisation. The subjects worked with the test, national test development. Where was I? So I had all the subjects, and we used to have to
work
across the organisation, but also we're selling out. But for me, when I was teaching, the real subject power, the experts, where I got all my ideas from, were HMI. So at that time, when I was teaching, HMI had something like 8 or 9 history specialists.
We're talking in the 70s and early 80s.
This would be the 70s and early 80s, yeah.
Did you say 50 special subject specialists?
No, I said 8 or 9.
8 or 9, sorry.
And certainly if you talk to somebody like John Hamer, who was Staff Inspector for History, and Roger Hennessy before that, they were very highly respected within the teaching profession. They were people who you hung on every word. When they produced reports, you always went through the bits that said, you know, good practice was seen in, and that was what you took. You used to think, right, I've got to do that. That's the kind of thing I've got to do. That was your model from those HMI history reports.
Can I just ask you about that? I've spoken to both Roger and John, and that was great. It was really nice to talk to them. But I did wonder the extent to which teachers did take notice of what the inspectorate said. Mm. I mean, there are thousands of history teachers, aren't there, all over the country. And you said 8 or 9 specialists, they would see, they would go to a county, visit schools, make some reports on that school on history, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
But they'd only also do general inspections.
Oh, yeah.
So the amount of time that would be spent on looking at actual history lessons would be fairly limited.
In the whole of my teaching career, I think I was inspected once.
So it's very different to Ofsted, isn't it?
Yeah, but what you picked up on were their general reports rather than their specific reports on school. The most significant book for me...
It's all right.
What's that one?
Oh, yes, I've got this, yes. And in fact, when I was teaching, I used to have it as well. It's a very nice book, actually.
Yeah. And that came out in the early 80s, I think.
It did, out in 1985.
Yeah.
But you see here, you've got schemes of work and content.
Mm-hmm.
How many history departments actually had a scheme of work that worked out in this way with the criteria of skills, the concepts and ideas? There would be some, but from my own personal experience...
Not all that many.
Mm. When I worked in, I was teaching from 1987 onwards.
Yeah.
The idea of having a detailed scheme of work really came in.
With O-level, with GCSE.
Well, no, after that. Well, yeah. See, we didn't have one really until the 90s. Well into the 90s, I don't think. That was really practical that you would actually use. Because there was still a lot of isolated working by members of staff.
Yeah. See, that influenced the GCSE history criteria.
Did it?
The history criteria then pervaded all the GCSE syllabuses, which had to be approved by SEAC, and I headed up the committee that did that approval, and John Hamer used to sit on that committee, or Roger Hennessy and then John Hamer.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you had the Ted Ragg referred to as the piston model of implementation, whereby... SEAC talked to the examining boards, and then the examining boards talked to local authorities, and then local authorities worked with schools to disseminate knowledge. And I became an advisor in 1986, or an advisory teacher rather, because ILIA wanted somebody who knew about GCSE. So I went into the History and Social Science Teacher Centre in Clapham. And the first job was to produce the training materials for GCSE training, along with Maureen Burns, and we turned the training material into a book, which, of course, has never even covered its royalties, because by the time it came out in 1988, it was being overtaken by National Curriculum Histories. Or 89, I suppose, it came out.
Yeah,
by which time, GCSE history was a bit passé, but...
So, really... Although, actually, GCSE was unaffected by national curriculum.
No, well, only just.
Mm.
I mean, what I was saying about GCSE history is that I think that caused history departments, because of the assessment, your point exactly in the seminar, because of the assessment, they had to start looking at sources and they had to start looking at change, cause and consequence. And so they had to start being much more objective-based, which they'd never been, I suspect, before. And I was looking back at my history syllabus from Archbishop Tennyson's, which I've also found.
Oh, I'd love to have a look at that.
And actually what you've got is an amended version, so you can see how it was changing, because it never stopped changing. And that's got objectives in, but I suspect it must be a fairly late version. It must be, I took over as head of department in 1978-79, I think, just after the school had become comprehensive. It was a grammar school that went comprehensive, as all inner London schools did. And the head of department, who'd been there since the war, decided that this intake was not for him. And he was right in one sense. I mean, he ended up his educational career quite bitter, because all the rhetoric about grammar schools and about teaching suggested that he'd been wasting his time. And yet he was a very old-fashioned, traditional teacher. And yet the kids loved him. He got kids through O-level, A-level to university. He died recently. I was at his funeral, and one of the pupils he taught and had taught them through, and I taught A-level to, is now a bishop, and was casting his mind back. You know, he sent this he wasn't able to make the funeral, but he sent this message for him. And you just think, well, you know, these people ended up bitter because they were told that, you know, grammar schools were a very bad thing, and that they not been teaching properly and this sort of thing. So he got out. He retired. Not early, I think he was 65. He went his time, and I took over, and that's when I introduced Schools History Project as the examination syllabus, as opposed to what we'd been doing from 1973 right the way through, which was 1815 to 1914.
So you switched from teaching in quite a conventional way with notes, giving notes, to the source-based work that was part and parcel of SHP?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Or had you already made some changes before?
It's quite interesting. They always say that when you start teaching, you teach history the way you were taught it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true.
Oh, stop.